let me go ahead and open the meeting and hope that Mr. Ferris joins us in a little bit. But for all those that are already on, welcome to the second Senior Statesman of Virginia Zoom meetings. As you all know, we've been doing meetings like this for 25 years now, and we're thrilled by the large number that have registered for this meeting. I have turned off all of the videos and everyone is muted except for our panelists and our moderator. Just so that you know, July is our traditional month off, and so we will not have a program in July, but we'll start again in August, and we've got an exciting group of programs starting again in August. You will be able to ask questions, and we're going to encourage you to send questions on the chat feature on the bottom of your screen. Occasionally it's on the top, but generally it's on the bottom, and it just says chat. Click on there, and the questions will come just to me, and I will forward them on to the moderator. But we encourage your questions. We'll let all the panelists speak first and then open it up for your questions at that time. Without further ado, let me introduce the moderator, Meg Hubeck, who is the Director of Instructions at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. If you don't know about the center, it's one of the treasures of the university as well as our community. The slogan is politics is good. Under Meg's leadership, the Youth Initiative Program has over 119,000 students and young people signed up for it, but it also has over almost 1,700 global students as part of their global program. Meg has a BA from Randolph-Macon, and she has an MA and a Master's of Science in Education and Arts, and she has traveled all over the world, including Sri Lanka and Afghanistan. But without further ado, Meg, let me turn the program over to you, please.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here with you this afternoon to talk about something that I'm really, really passionate about, and that is Virginia politics. So I'm really glad to be here with some friends that I have known for a while, and some new friends, and some neighbors, and to talk about the Virginia General Assembly and the very exciting year that we have had, 2020, 2019 and 2020. 2020 has turned out to be quite the Lulu. So I think we can all agree on that. And so we're going to have a really good time this afternoon talking about the General Assembly session and looking forward as to what's to come next. And as we say, politics is a good thing. And thank you so much to all of you for being here and being so interested in what's going on in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I want to introduce our panelists very briefly to you and then let them talk to you for a few minutes about themselves and about what they thought about the 2019-20 session. So I guess we'll go ahead and get started. I'm going to start with our two newbies. I hope you don't mind and are not offended that I would call you that, but you're very, very special to us. And I'm going to start with Miss Sally Hudson, ladies first. I hope you don't mind that as well. Miss Sally Hudson is representing Virginia's 57th district, which is Charlottesville and Albemarle. She is a teacher and an economist, amongst other things, and is an assistant professor at the University of Virginia. She was elected in 2019, and we are glad to have her with us here today. Thank you so much for being here, Sally Hudson. And secondly, we have Chris Runyon, who represents myself. Mm-hmm. And he is representing Virginia's 25th district, which is the region of Virginia, Stanton, Augusta, Waynesboro, and parts of Rockingham County as well as Western Albemarle County. And you also were elected in 2019, so we'd like to welcome you to the General Assembly, and we're so glad that you are there. You are also very busy with the Augusta Chamber of Commerce, and we thank you again for your service and welcome you to our panel. And Cree Deeds, who has been serving Virginia for the longest amount of time on our panel today and has done so many things, and is representing Virginia's 25th senatorial district, Albemarle, Bath, Highland, Nelson, Rockbridge, and has also run for both the governorship and the Commonwealth's attorney. So thank you for being with us here, Mr. Deeds. We're glad to have you. And it's always good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, Meg.
We're expecting Mr. Matt Ferris from the 59th district, and I hope that he will join us. So if he comes in, he represents Campbell, Appomattox, Buckingham, Nelson, and Albemarle. So he hopefully will be joining us soon. And without that, I think we should get started. And I think we'll start with Senator Deeds.
Thanks, Meg.
He would like to go ahead and make a statement.
Sure. And I'll just talk for a couple of minutes because I'm more interested in your questions than anything. It's such an incredible pleasure to think that I get to serve in the General Assembly, and I appreciate the honor so much. This is about 29th legislative session. You know, time flies whether you're having fun or not. Time flies. It's hard to believe it's been 29 years. But I will tell you, this was the most intense session, the busiest session I think I've ever been through. My committee assignments changed a little bit this year. I became the chair of the Privileges and Elections Committee. I went on the Finance Committee. I became the chair of the Capital Outlay Subcommittee, which deals with state debt and capital improvements. And I became the chair of the Criminal Law Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. So I really had my hands full. At the end of the day, I was on 25 different conference committees. One of those was a budget conference, which meant that I didn't have time for a whole lot of frivolity. At the end of the session, I was, you know, while other legislators might have gone out to have something to eat at night, I was on the 13th or 14th floor of the building trying to figure out how to put a budget together. And frankly, you know, what we were asked for this meeting was to talk about our what I think the greatest accomplishment and the biggest disappointment. You know, we are in a different place than we were when the General Assembly ended on March 12th. I would have said on March 12th, our biggest accomplishment was we put together a budget that I thought adequately met the needs of the Commonwealth of Virginia. We were able to restore funding for K-12 education to a pre-2008 level. That had been a long-term goal, but to get our funding back to the pre-recession level, and we were finally able to accomplish that. We were able to put a significant amount of new money in healthcare, providing a dental benefit for adults on Medicaid, joining the majority of the rest of the states, putting lots of new money in mental health and taking us further steps toward completing our Step Virginia goal. We were able to put significant money in transportation and parks and all the things that are important to me and the people I represent. The biggest disappointment is that as a result of the pandemic,
right,
we had to put a hold on $2.2 billion worth of spending. And we're going to have to go back in August for probably, my guess is the first week or two of August, we will be back in session to try to figure out what to do about the hole in the budget. And the hole in the budget is liable to grow bigger than $2.2 billion. It's liable to grow and upwards of $3 billion. And that is frightening for those of us who care about the services that people so rightly need and demand from the state. We've got a significant amount of work to do. What else I think we'll be able to accomplish then, you know, we took some steps with respect to criminal justice during this past session. We decriminalized marijuana possession. We made sure that people whose driver's licenses have been suspended because they can't pay their fines, that endless cycle of debt is going to be ended. People are going to be able to get their driver's license and go to work. We were able to double the amount of the felony threshold. We did some significant things, but we were blocked in a number of other areas. And I'm hopeful that some of those can be addressed in the August special session. If not, next January, we'll come back to those. But it was really an intense session. For Delegate Hudson and Delegate Runyon, I know it was your first one. They're not all like this, but as I said, I've been doing it for a long time, and every session's a little bit different. And this one was a real humdinger to break the ice in. But I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
I like that word, humdinger. It connotates a lot of energy, and I think I don't know. I felt a lot of energy kind of coming off. With the election of so many kind of new faces,
yes,
going into the General Assembly. Chris, I'm going to let you go next.
Well, I appreciate that.
Give us your reflections.
Thank you. And I really do appreciate the senator's comments. And I appreciate the word humdinger. You know, I think that would probably be a great apt description. I have also used the word that it was topsy-turvy, and the world we're in today is topsy-turvy. I appreciate the opportunity to kind of get the idea of what we were going to talk about. And as this being my first session, didn't have anything to compare to other than conversations with folks that have been there before. I think that our greatest achievement was bipartisan or nonpartisan redistricting. I think that really does matter to the folks of the Commonwealth. And, you know, 50 or 100 years from now, people are going to look back and say, yeah, I'm really glad the General Assembly did that. Some things that maybe specifically for our district would be Delegate Plum's bill relating to agriculture that both promotes and protects agriculture, and the water quality. The WHIP 3 is the name of it. And those were positive steps forward that I think were collaboration among all parties. And that's where we have to be. The other thing that I think is of particular interest in Western Albemarle, as well as the other portions of the 25th District, is the expansion of broadband. There were significant commitments made for broadband support. I would agree with the senator that we've now got a new world out there, and monies that were planned to be spent are going to have to be spent in other and different ways. One of the goals that I had coming into the session was to reach across the aisle and build relationships. And I was a little bit surprised in how much effort it took to build relationships with administrative and the folks in the agencies. I hadn't considered that, but we worked hard at that. And I feel like there were good opportunities, good growth in building those relationships. One of the things that I'm very proud of is a freshman delegate, Shelley Simons from the Newport News area. We formed the Career and Technical Education Caucus. Career and technical education are important to each of us and a number of others, and maybe for different reasons. You know, in the district, particularly the western portion of our district, there's needs for particular career and technical education, education activities and additional jobs. Merck's $1 billion expansion in Rockingham County was driven much by the ability to educate the workers for the jobs today and the jobs in the future. Otherwise, those jobs would have gone somewhere else. So we're excited about moving forward on that. So we think that was a very positive thing. There were some other areas that I thought were very opportunity to be bipartisan. The Solar Freedom Bill that Delegate Keem sponsored, I was able to support that and thought that made a lot of sense, and was pleased to be able to be a part of that. My greatest disappointment, and I wrote another note down based on the senator's comments there, the financial impact. You're right. Extremely concerned, and we're not quite sure where that hole's going to end up. It's going to impact everybody's lives, and our job's going to be figure out how to minimize that impact and then move away from that as quickly as we can. And I think that, again, is a bipartisan issue. We've got to have conversations across the aisle and figure out where we can be together on those things. Other areas that I thought, and maybe it's because of my first term, I thought there were times that legislation that was not allowed to be matured. The conversations that where there were opposing points of view sometimes didn't take place. And I think what I'm concerned is that there's legislation that's going to come forward that has not been appropriately vetted, and it's going to have unintended consequences on the Commonwealth. I may be wrong. If I am, I am. But that was probably the thing that I took away at the last day of the session, of things that I wished would have been done differently. I have some thoughts for next year, and we can get into that later. And I don't want to take all the time up. And I want to thank you, Meg and Richard, for y'all putting this together. I truly do appreciate this.
Well, we're going to talk about those things later. So you hold on to those thoughts most definitely. Thank you very much. Sally, it's up to you. Tell us what your thoughts were upon your first session. Oh, you're on mute.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I'm happy to be here with my fellow freshman, Chris. And I'm always thrilled to be with Senator Deeds. You know, when we're getting adjusted as first timers, it always means the world to have someone down the hall who can give us a little bit of perspective. I'm always also reminded whenever Cree and I are on a panel together that he's been in public service as long as I've been alive. So I, as you mentioned, Meg, in introduction, I'm an economist. I'm on the faculty at the university. So perhaps not surprising, I'm on the finance committee, which means that on the House side, which means that I will be one of those people who's trying to figure out how we fill that big new hole in the budget. I also serve on the technology and the natural resources committees, which are near and dear to my heart. Like Delegate Runyon, one of the things that I was most proud of were the steps that we took forward to protect our environment and to finally really empower clean energy producers in the Commonwealth who've been held back for so long. I know that being a good steward of our natural resources is important to all of us here in Central Virginia and the Valley, but I think especially to those of us who will have to be stewards of the planet for a little longer and understand the ticking talk of climate change that we're facing. So I really applaud all of the work that went into that. And I hope we can keep our foot on the gas as we go forward and continue to make progress there. And then, you know, like the senator, I think my biggest disappointment with the session is that so much of that good work that we did with the budget will have to be rolled back. Those such critical investments in our schools, in our healthcare, in the people who have really been falling through the cracks for too long in Virginia. And it really pains me that we were so close and we'll now have to do it again. But I think, you know, anytime you've got a big shakeup like this, I think we also have an opportunity in that this crisis has forced us to reevaluate and reprioritize in a way that I hope will center a lot of those services in the budget so that we can think of them as core to what we do and not as afterthoughts. You know, I've had some good chances now being back in Charlottesville to talk with our first responders and our fire chiefs. And they tell you about how we should have had more public health in the budget for years, and that would have made us more resilient to deal with this crisis. And so I hope we can listen to those people who are doing that firsthand service and come back with a budget that puts our most important needs first.
Yeah, I think thinking back on the last week or so in Virginia and nationally, and thinking about the hole that we have, right, with COVID really taking the breath out of the economy and really putting us in a place where we have to look at our priorities. What are we going to do in terms of like equity and not only racial equity, which we have to do something about, but we have an educational gap, we have financial inequity, we have these gaps. Let's talk a little bit about what we think we should do or what you think you're going to do in terms of prioritizing how we deal with how do you think as a legislature you're going to have to deal with these challenges moving forward from this point? So let's talk about the whole. That's an easier way to put it. What do you think we should do?
Well, the whole right now is $2.2 billion, and that's basically the new spending. Now, when you've got a budget that's around $120 billion over 2 years, $2.2 billion is not a huge part of that budget. It's a little about 2%, but that's still significant. You know, what we have to do, it seems to me, is we've got to figure out, you know, as Delegate Hudson pointed out, You know, we've got an incredible opportunity in the middle of all this crisis. You know, we've got an opportunity, I think, to make the system work better for more people. You know, just like the criminal justice issues that we're going to ultimately have an opportunity to figure out. And there seems to be growing consensus about some of those things and across this party lines. We're going to have to come together as a legislature and figure out, you know, and the legislature, it's easy for us to talk now, but it's 140 different people, you know, two parties, but 140 different people that bring different viewpoints from different parts of the state and different priorities to the table. We're going to have to figure out which priorities are most important to the people of the Commonwealth of Virginia and what we can't afford to live without, because right now, you know, we have, you know, I've been in the General Assembly long enough to been through periods of recession, been through periods of retrenchment, but, and also to have lived through a few days of the fatted calf when there seems to be a feast. Well, we thought we had a feast in February and March, and it turns out now we're going to have to do some retrenching. I can't wave a magic wand and tell you what the majority will agree, but my priorities will stay the same: education, healthcare, public safety, things that are important to the majority people I represent.
I think one of the things that this recession in particular highlights is that our tax code is upside down in Virginia, that our budget is entirely too reliant on the sources of revenue that are hardest hit by this particular recession. You know, our sales taxes, our fines and fees, our gas taxes. You know, we have a top income tax bracket in Virginia that kicks in at $18,000. And so we tax millionaires and minimum wage earners at the same rate. And you cannot have a budget that is designed to protect the most vulnerable people first if you don't kind of turn that on its head and ask those that have more to give more in, to our investments in each other. There are a lot of other sources of revenue that lots of other states that we'd like to think of as our peers are already using that we leave off the table in Virginia. And I think that's, you know, we have a tax code that has been designed over the last 20, 30 years under different leadership. And so I, one of the things that I'm excited to do to come back is, yeah, I noticed somebody just popped into the chat. They asked, should we expect tax increases or spending cuts? I think we should expect both, and we should shift them in our priorities, that we can do different kinds of taxation and different kinds of spending, because there's some of both. I mean, there's a lot of the budget hole can be closed by tax loopholes and tax credits that might not reflect our top priorities in a crisis like this. And I also think that there's low-hanging fruit for revenue that we can put back on the table. So it's a little bit of both, but it's about aligning both taxes and spending, like the senator was saying, with what I at least really think of are the core duties of government, of education, healthcare, infrastructure, and put those things first.
So Delegate Runyon, you mentioned the watershed implementation bill. So could kind of be an example of something we want to might keep, because we obviously want to protect natural resources such as the Bay. And I know we had the Virginia Clean Energy Act passed, and that's something that we need to work on to keep our natural resources clean. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that a little bit more and how we might work to prioritize clean energy and clean resources as we go through these financial difficulties?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And Meg, by the way, you're cutting out your audio.
Oh.
And I'm not sure if everybody else is hearing that, but I missed part of what you're saying.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you
okay.
all hear me? Did anyone else not have trouble?
Yes, you cut in and out. I could tell that.
Oh, okay.
Too many people have their microphones probably not muted. I would suggest that we all mute our microphones unless we're talking.
So, you know, if we're talking about the general question of how do we prioritize, and then specifically the environmental impact and the things that WIP3 has brought forward, and again, for me, it was really important that the agriculture community and the environmental community, and others included. We had conversations with folks that operate wastewater treatment plants and their concerns about how the legislation was crafted months before the General Assembly. And so I think we all came together where it was a reasonable compromise, reasonable solution. Prioritizing, you know, I go back as the senator was talking, and was that, you know, we share those same core values or core priorities: education, public safety, energy, environment. I wrote down energy. I meant to write down environment. It perhaps is how we go about getting there, and that's where we have to have those conversations to do that. Without knowing what type of financial impact we're going to see relating to COVID on the budget, you can sit here and say, yes, the Chesapeake Bay is one of those things that we want to keep, or WIP 3, we want to keep funded at the levels it is, but we may not be able to. And you know, when we see those numbers, then we can make those decisions. It is critical. One of the challenges I think you have in a situation like this is we've got to remember that we're here for the long game as well. We got to get through the short term. We've got to address issues. You know, it's interesting. Our day-to-day lives in our legislative office is dealing with people's unemployment challenges, people's business challenges, whether they to connect them with the right people in the administration so they can get questions answered. And that's pretty much an 8-hour day for us. And it's been quite surprising to me how much that is consuming our constituents' lives. So we've got a short-term game to get place, but let's make sure we keep the long-term. I would say that Senator Deed's experience in serving in the General Assembly for the years that he has, including his comment that he's been through the fatted times and the lean times, is he and others like that is going to help us understand better what we can do and what's appropriate to do.
Yeah, we had a question, and I think you referenced it about longer-term projects, and I think you kind of covered that in that answer.
If I could just add something, you know, none of us really knows how this is going to impact the budget in the long term. You know, if, for example, the Congress passes another bill, one that sends money to directly to state and local government, we would then be able to backfill a lot of the things that we already, you know, have appropriated money for that are on hold right now. The CARES money that was sent, you know, had a lot of strings attached, and we can't use it to backfill. But we don't know what the federal government's going to do, and not all the indicators that we're seeing from a budgetary standpoint suggest that we're going to have long-term problems. You know, we could. That's why we still have to be fairly flexible between now and when we go into special session.
So thinking about in the past week, there's been a lot of movement in terms of removing of the statues, particularly in Richmond. And I wanted to think of that as, is this a bold movement signaling constant and meaningful change within the state, or is it just lip service to try to show that something is being done, but we'll kind of go back to business as usual? Love to know what what your opinions on that are.
You know, my sense is the governor's announcement is a bold move. The movement of the Robert E. Lee statute is a significant move. You know, the reality is that as long as that statute remains, it's going to be the target of and a center point of discussion. State imprimatur ought to be on things that unite us. Right now, that statute is a divider. So I don't think that was just a fad. I think that it was a bold move by the governor. You know, Mayor Stoney announced that he's going to seek legislation July 1, like the legislation I think that will happen in Charlottesville. The General Assembly, one of the most significant things that passed this past year was something we all worked on that basically allows local governments to make decisions about what happens to statutory in the locality. And so that's a process that's going to be deliberate, that will allow people to have a lot of input, and will allow a process to take place so that the artwork is protected, or there's a There's a effort to protect it anyway, but ultimately the local governments will be able to decide. With respect to the Robert E. Lee statute, I guess you've looked at the Richmond paper this morning. There are at least a couple of challenges to the governor's right. action. And the legal actions that have been filed actually are pretty interesting. And so that the question of what ultimately happens there is really up in the air, but I think it was bold on the governor's part. I think that the statute itself is something that divides the community, and therefore, I think the governor, what the governor did was bold.
I think it is a bold move as well, and I want to thank Senator Deeds for his partnership in this last session in laying a lot of the groundwork legally for understanding what it means to move the different statutes. We were both very deeply involved in that legislation and helped us understand how the many different statutes and their ownership guidelines affect, who can and when to move it. I think that's bold, not just because it takes a divisive emblem out of our public spaces, but because it has become a lightning rod for public education for so many people. There are entire generations of Virginians who are just now becoming aware that those statues were part of a coordinated campaign to present a misleading version of history on the part of the Daughters of the Confederacy and their allies about why the Civil War was fought and Virginia's progress since then. For people who are finally beginning to come to understand the fullness of that history, that's going to leave a lasting mark on so many conversations that we have going forward. I think whether or not we actually deliver real policy change that's rooted in that understanding is really on all of us. It's about whether or not we stay vigilant and continue to stay invested in those and to push our elected leaders to make and deliver real progress, or if we kind of rest on our laurels and take these symbolic victories. So I would like to affirm the governor's decision and then also really charge all of us with making sure that we deliver that second stage.
It's just been such an interesting week with those in terms of just with the whole week with the George Floyd protests and things going on in Richmond in terms of them coming down after so much going on here in Charlottesville and then going back and forth. And that was a huge, I thought that was a real interest, a very powerful piece of policy that really gave a lot of power back to the people in terms of what you were able to do in that General Assembly session. Here we have another question. Are deeds of gifts typically in place? Oops, let me look at this one second. One thing about Zoom is I'm a slow reader and the chat box comes up and then by the time I've read it, it's gone away. Are deeds of gifts
I saw the question. Here's the thing. The property where the lease statute was a larger tract of land that was deeded by Henrico County to Virginia, I think in the late 1880s, with some restrictions that the Lee Monument was to be protected and revered for all eternity. So the court has to interpret that. And as it was pointed out in the paper this morning, that's a thorny issue. I mean, I think that how you're going to interpret that, it could happen any number of ways. And I don't know how that's going to work out, but my perspective is, and I'm, my family was in Virginia during the time of the Civil War. I grew up going to Richmond and thinking Monument Avenue was a pretty interesting place. I grew up a student of history. But that statue is a divider now. And it's, things change. We have to be about uniting people. We have to be about promoting symbols that represent all of us, that appeal to all of us, because we have to move forward together. We have to build an economy and a state that works for everybody. And as long as this is in the way, the governor is correct in what he's doing. But that's got to be interpreted by the courts, the deed.
I'm going to ask a question that is personal to my heart, which is about gerrymandering. I have to tell you something. I am on the regional board of One Virginia 2021. I cannot tell a lie. It's something, as I'm a teacher, And I have to tell you that in all of my teaching, I just always, I'm from Maryland, and we have the opposite problem in Maryland that we have in Virginia. It's like the mirror reverse, in that people don't get, you don't really have a say in Maryland if you are not a Democrat, and sometimes vice versa. So I've for a long time just feel like it's important that voters feel like when they go to the polls that they have, that they get to select their legislators as opposed to legislators picking their voters. And so I've been working a long time with One Virginia 2021 to work to end nonpartisan redistricting in Virginia. And so this year, that was a big deal in the General Assembly. And we had, and as you know, what happened on the last day of the session, let me see what I wrote down. I have to write. Was that it came down to, I apologize. I wrote everything, all my notes down, and now they're blowing around in the wind. But anyway, many of the people who said that they were for nonpartisan redistricting basically no longer wanted to support it as fully as they had in the past. But now it's going to be on the ballot in November. And I'd love to know how you feel about that and what that means for Virginia moving forward.
Is there somebody you want to go first?
It doesn't matter. Whoever. It's an open question. My fault.
Okay. In 2002 or 2003, I introduced my first attempt at nonpartisan redistricting. You know, and I think you're exactly right. You know, we ought to be about the people picking the electeds, not the electeds picking their people. I agree with that. And I voted for the bill that passed this year, and I chaired the committee that went through.
Yeah.
I didn't hesitate to vote for it. But I will tell you, it's not what Virginia 2021 introduced last year. It's not what I introduced. It's flawed process. It's flawed because, number one, it doesn't, the process will go to the voters in the fall. The criteria, which is the rule, is the rulemaking process that governs redistricting, stays, it's going to be set by the legislature every year. There are in this process, there are legislators are going to be part of the panel that draws the lines, and the plan will come back to the legislature for approval. So it's not a perfect proposal. You know, as we've discussed in the past, I've discussed with Delegate Hudson, I'm hopeful that the process, once it's approved by the voters this fall, will be subject to further amendment in years to come, so that the process can be made more perfect.
Okay, good. That's what I meant to say, but I can't find my new paper because it blew away.
Yeah, I would add, I mean, gerrymandering is a problem that is as old as the country. Excuse me, I need to turn off notifications from other things at people buzzing me. Gerrymandering is a problem that's as old as the country. I mean, the very first gerrymander happened here in Virginia. And we always knew that fixing the problem was going to be harder here in Virginia than it is in other states, because we don't have a citizen-led ballot initiative. The way that other states have succeeded in moving further, faster with a cleaner commission is by having citizens put forward a proposal like the one that One Virginia 2021 did from the start. We are hampered by the fact that our constitutional amendment process starts with the legislature. And so we needed the legislators to voluntarily disarm, which is a very difficult thing to get the General Assembly to do. And so we didn't get an amendment that is as strong as the one we might like. One of the principal weaknesses of it is that it still has both legislators and citizens on the commission. And that was as much as this body was willing to muster this time around. I won't speak for others, but I know I sure would want us to work toward a fully independent commission, but the Senate made very clear that that was not going to happen this year. There was a citizen-only commission statutory alternative that went through the Senate and found itself amended with some legislators put back on it, which I think was the final clear sign that was not an option before us. And so I voted for the amendment because I think it's much better than the status quo. For the very first time, the process is going to happen out in the open. For the very first time, we're going to have constitutional protections enshrined that dictate that communities of color have the opportunity to elect a candidate of their choice, which is essential. And then I think it's also much better for the future. I see this amendment as a springboard to the next one, that we'll be able to pass the stronger amendment once we have this one under our belt. And I think it's very important to remind ourselves that the path forward for that stronger amendment is the same whether or not this one passes. That we can, you know, it's no harder to amend this new constitution than it is to amend the old one as it was. But I think it's much more likely that we will. Because the people who oppose the amendment come in two stripes, people who want more reform and people who want none. And by getting this measure under our belt, I think it's much more likely that we'll take that final step to get that gold standard reform that other states were able to achieve starting from the citizens in the ground up.
You put that so well. I just want to tell you.
Oh, thank you.
And put that in words. So I thank you so much for putting that so eloquently. That was great. Thank you. That was great. What about, and another question that was emailed to us.
Sorry for cutting you off. No, worries at all. So, and it is one of the top achievements that I think we as a legislative body achieved this year. And it was interesting because when this first came more on my radar screen, I had no intent of being an elected official. I was just a citizen and was unhappy with how things were moving, was unhappy with how districts were going last time. And so it started, and Emmett Hanger and I, Senator Hanger and I had a long conversation several years ago about that. So that helped me to understand it better. I agreed with what I think Sally said, we need more reform. This is good. It is not perfect. I don't know that we ever get to perfect, but we'll get it better. And so I'm looking forward in a bipartisan manner to move forward and improve that. Ultimately, everybody understands the goal is for citizens to pick their elected officials.
Exactly.
And what we've been doing has not been in the appropriate way. So it was exciting to see how all that came about and all the conversations, particularly on the House side. When I was doing a little prep, I noticed that both the senator and the delegate and I were all on the same page. And I think Delegate Ferris voted for the bill as well. So there's one of those things that we all cross party lines to get to.
Yeah, it's good for everybody. It really is. It's something that can really benefit Virginia as a whole. I think that's really important. Another voting question that came in was about online voting versus mail-in voting, whether or not we think that that's just something that we should discuss here in Virginia for the fall, was whether or not we should do that mail-in voting should be expanded for the general election in fall because of COVID. So I'd love to hear your opinions, whether vote by mail, what are the pros and cons of voting by mail, expanding that for voting in the fall?
You know, I don't know if that will really be addressed in the August special session. It could be. But, you know, we passed this year for the first time no excuse absentee voting. We've seen a huge uptick in voting. And in fact, I was just on another Zoom a few minutes ago with some folks over in Charlottesville. And I know they've had an incredible uptick in people who have voted or requested to vote in this upcoming primary, Republican primary, by mail. So, you know, I want as many people as possible to vote in a way that they feel safe. You know, in this COVID world we live in now, we have to always be careful about health. We need to be about promoting people to stay safe, but also to participate in the process. And I think that's going to require that more people vote by mail. Having said that, it seems to me that we have to always keep our polls open to the extent possible, because there's some people that just aren't going to be able to vote by mail. And if we require people to vote that way, we are probably going to exclude some people from the process. And we shouldn't be about that. We should be about including as many qualified voters as possible in the process of electing our leadership.
If I can tack on to what Senator Dietz said, because I think that there's something that may be familiar to us legislators, but I find I've been explaining to constituents a lot lately, and that is how the special session will work. So we don't yet have a date for the special session. We know that the governor has some plans to call us back near the tail end of the summer so we can revisit the budget. And we don't yet know the scope of that session. Will we just be looking at the budget, or might we also be looking at some criminal justice reform or a broader lens? One thing that is important to know is the timing for how bills that we pass become a law. In Virginia, if we pass a bill, even if the governor were to sign it right away, it doesn't take effect for 4 months. And so if we pass a new law in August, that law is not going to be in effect in time for a November election, unless we were to pass it with what's called an emergency clause. And that requires a 4/5 vote of the General Assembly of the body. And so it requires an enormous amount of agreement across party lines in order to do something that takes effect quickly. And so unless the proposal that you have is the kind of thing that we can get behind with unanimity almost, then it's very unlikely that it can kick in real quick. The earliest that you might see any new proposals coming out of that special session becoming law, absent that emergency clause, is December. So for that reason, I think it's unlikely that we would see dramatic changes in vote by mail before the November election.
Chris, you have anything to add with that about vote by mail preference?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm on the opposite side of how the senator and the delegate voted on those issues. My concern was how do you maintain security in the voting process? And you know, there's philosophical differences, and that's why we're on the other side of the aisle. So I will say, though, that Senator Deeds is correct that, you know, we've got a different world now. So let's have those conversations. I don't know that I can move. I may still end up where I am, but I'm willing to listen and understand, because I do believe we've had fundamental changes that are occurring in society, and we're going to have to recognize those. Part of what Virginia's legislative body has been very good at for 400 years is being able to have conversations so we can get to the point where it's beneficial to all the Commonwealth.
Great.
Thank you.
From Robert McGrath to everyone on the panel, the Virginia Clean Energy Act, Delegate Runyon voted against it. Senator Deeds and Delegate Hudson voted for it. Please, each of you, give us your thinking on the Virginia Clean Energy Act.
Yeah, my thinking is that this issue of climate change is existential. We have to figure a way to reduce the amount of carbon in our atmosphere and to figure a sustainable way to produce the energy that's going to continue to drive our economy and drive a civilization for the foreseeable future. This act is about an economic way. It's not doesn't bring as much change as another bill, I think, that Sam Rasul introduced, but it brings about a change that allows us to move to a renewable economy. The reality is that's going to cost money, and I think that's what this bill recognizes. It goes a little bit slower, perhaps, than the Rasul bill would have gone, the Clean Energy Act, but it still moves us towards a renewable economy, and I think that's the way we're going to have to go if we're going to sustain a human population on this earth. We have to think about ways to reduce things like carbon and mercury from our environment.
So the VCEA is the Virginia Clean Economy Act. And I will tell you, as an economist, the energy in this bill is cleaner than the economics. It does a lot of investment in wind and solar in great ways, but it also includes a lot of giveaways to our utilities to invest in those resources at costs that are above what would be the competitive prices that would build the consumers. So it's true, this bill is going to cost even more money than it would have to if we were just trying to do right by consumers. And so I was really actively engaged in the development of that legislation to make it more aggressive to both combat our climate crisis at the rate that climate change requires, but also to ensure that consumers are getting a fair shake in the process. I know that there are some folks who voted against the bill because they're concerned about those costs. The thing that I would charge to those people is, were they actively involved in trying to improve it? I find it a little bit hard to believe the folks who voted against the bill, but were not offering up amendments for how to make it better. I think that that's the real mark of a legislator who is invested in the climate change policy, is that they're trying to improve these measures rather than shooting it down, because doing nothing is not an option for those of us who intend to live on the planet for another few decades, if we're lucky.
So I opposed the bill because I thought it was too much, too fast. I think the economics, it's interesting, Sally's comment about the economics weren't good with the giveaways. Those are concerns to me as well. What I'd like to do is focus on the consumer and be able to provide that. And I do understand we need to move towards a sustainable economy and protect the environment. But I was uncomfortable that what was in front of us at this point in time was the appropriate way to do it. I'm very concerned with the economic impact on average Virginians. And, many of us can afford an increase in electric bills on a monthly basis, and it's not going to change our lives. But boy, there's lots of folks out there that's not true. And that maybe is one of those areas that I thought the conversation wasn't as complete as it perhaps to be. But I also just heard Sally, and, I didn't offer any amendments. And so I take your comment with the tone that it's offered. And so I would be happy to be re-engaged as we move forward next year. How do we figure out the things that do make sense so both sides of the conversation can occur?
I like that. Okay, so I have a question for Senator Deeds. Can you explain the different components of gun control legislation considered and why you supported some and opposed some? Is there an opportunity to move forward in the future to improve safety?
I tried to look at each one of those bills on their own merits and demerits as I saw it. I'm a guy that grew up hunting. I grew up in the woods. I still have guns. I haven't hunted for a long time, but I'm still a country guy. And I looked at every one of those bills individually. I voted for most of them. I didn't vote for the bill that would ban assault style weapons, even though, I get it. I don't think the Second Amendment applies to assault style weapons. I think even Justice Scalia wrote that the Second Amendment doesn't apply to weapons of war. Assault style weapons are semi-automatic weapons that with large magazines that are capable of being used in assault. And a lot of them have been used in massacres, public massacres. And I looked hard at that legislation. As I saw it, there were three flaws to it. Number one, the definition was so broad that I was afraid it could include a lot of guns that have large magazines that aren't assault style weapons, guns that have been in use in the communities that I represent for many years. Number two, that assault style weapon is an article of private property. The Constitution says you can't take people's life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and you can't take their private property without just compensation. And when you say it's legal on June 30, but it's illegal on July 1, and you're not buying it back, you're creating, I think, a constitutional problem. But number three, maybe the bigger question, is there just so many of those guns out there? There are probably tens of thousands of assault-style weapons in private homes all over Virginia. How in the world do you enforce it? The county I live in borders on West Virginia. If we're going to pass an assault style weapon ban, but they don't pass one in West Virginia, my constituents out here are just going to go over there and buy. I don't know that it was enforceable. Is there an opportunity to go forward? Sure there is. The motion I made was not to kill the bill, but to pass it by for the year and let it go to the Crime Commission to study. The governor and the House and the Senate are reconstituting the Crime Commission with a group of people that I think are going to be really interested in this legislation. And they're going to be interested in figuring a way to improve it, to address some of those questions, because the things I'm saying now aren't things that I'm saying for the first time. We've had those conversations time and time again. We had those conversations before the session to try to figure out which bills we could advance and which bills we're not going to advance. And it was crystal clear to everybody, at least on in the Senate on my side, what was going to happen. There were no surprises. That was the primary piece of legislation that people seemed to be concerned about that didn't pass. But most of the other bills I voted for. Most of the other high-profile bills.
I have one question here. What effect do you see the removal of the Confederate statues will have on actual history of the Commonwealth? Where has Delegate Hudson gotten her information on the coordinated effort to tell a false history with the statues?
Well, that's well-established history that you'd find in any U.S. history class now taught at the University of Virginia. They're fantastic faculty, Dr. Jelaine Schmidt, Dr. Andrea Douglas, who runs the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center here in town. The legacy of the Daughters of the Confederacy, whose headquarters is still in Richmond, Virginia, is at this point very well established. So I think that it's incumbent upon all of us to understand that part of our history, that's been an active effort to tell history on the side of the people who lost the war. And that's not usually something that we do to honor the people who led a war to tear us apart and to suppress a lot of people who are just as American as you or me at this point.
And I think even if you go and look at the statues, somewhere on them, there's a plaque or a small, there's a thing that says exactly who put them there.
Right.
And so you can actually go and look if you look closely at them, you can find that information out pretty easily. So it's not hidden anywhere. So just to put that
out. And it's very important. I mean, if you think about those of us here in Charlottesville and Albemarle, it's definitely not telling our history because Robert E. Lee never set foot in our city. There's no battle or moment that ever took place that the Lee statue in the park that's just down the street from my home is about nothing that happened here in Charlottesville. It's about throwing down another marker to remember a version of the war that doesn't express our full history or humanity together.
I would highly recommend that if you want to learn more about that legacy, that people would take it up, go down to the Jefferson School and take some time there and really talk and look at the resources that they have. And you can learn a lot about the statuary in Charlottesville and go down and into Richmond. There's lots of information that you can find out about the history of those statues, and it won't take you very long and find out some really good facts. So as an ending question, I'm going to throw you a softball. I would love for you, well, first of all, I know Delegate Hudson and Delegate Runyon, you got to be outside, correct? Didn't you to have part of your session outside? What was that? How was that?
It was interesting. It was interesting. It went fine. So
I wondered if it was like when my students always ask me, can we have class outside? Like, that's going to be really exciting. And it is, but it's never as exciting as you think it's going to be.
It's not the most efficient way to run a meeting, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. It's not as always efficient to have a class outside either. But I want you to tell me the thing that all three of you, I want you to tell me to talk about what you're looking forward to about not maybe your August session, because that's coming up quite quickly, but what you're looking forward to in the next session, the next full session that you attend. Like, what is the issue that you're just burning to work for, the thing that gets you up in the morning excited to work on, the thing that you're most looking forward to working on next?
For the past 6+ years, I've been working hard to rebuild our system of public mental health. And we developed a plan called Step Virginia that we are still a few steps from completing. And this pandemic is taking the wind out of our sails, but I'm looking forward to getting that wind back. I'm looking forward to building momentum and finishing the job. of rebuilding a system that provides public mental health to people wherever they are that have need.
I think it's probably created even a greater need for it after we've all really probably created even a greater need for it as a result of not being able to access healthcare and things like that while we've been shut in. So I commend you on that and send you good wishes. And I know that you'll be excited about it. Let's move on to Delegate Hudson.
I think the work that I'm most excited to continue is combating climate change. And I think that there's just no more urgent work for my generation. You know, throughout human history, we've been doing the long, slow, boring of hard boards in politics and stepping forward. But climate change is the first problem we're trying to solve where the clock is ticking down. And that means that we can't afford to just take our progress in little bits and pieces and hope that the next generation does better than the last. We have to work now to ensure that my kids get to have a next generation. And so that's, I think, you know, sometimes I think young people can sound a little bit alarmist, but that's because that is the magnitude of the problem that we're facing. And so I'm very committed to going back to Richmond and continuing my part of that work for us.
Excellent. The buck stops at you, at us, at us.
It does. All of us. Yeah. That's a good point that we all are in this together. And that includes all the citizens of the Commonwealth. I'm looking at Matt a little more specifically. And one of the things that I've tried to bring across is that historically I'm a listener. I think that we make better decisions when we have conversations. And you've got to listen to have that conversation. So I'm working hard on that. To be frank about it, COVID has created a very unsettled time for me because I can't get out and about with the restrictions we've had. I'm so happy we've started to open up the economy so I can get out and see people. That's a way that I'm most comfortable doing it, but we're working it out. The individual issues, career and technical education I've already shared. We were fortunate to be able to carry a bill that benefited the ARC, or it was for the ARC, it benefited the disability community relating to some education things. And group of our most vulnerable citizens are very close to my heart. So we're working on legislation to bring forward to, again, help improve their circumstances. Senator Deeds talked about mental health. That's a very important area for me as well. It's important in our community, but it's easy to see how much COVID has impacted the lives of many folks in our community. And so I'd be really interested to chat as we have in the future to see where there's some things that we can reach across the aisle and work together to achieve those, because it's a big need. The other one is a little bit kind of a narrow focus is a new delegate as well. And I talked at a veterans issue, and there's some holes in the veterans gambling treatment opportunities out there. And so we've talked a little bit about beginning that process. And so over the next couple of months, we'll work on legislation that could improve that. So looking forward to the opportunity. I think most importantly, what I'm looking forward is to have conversations with our constituents and folks throughout the Commonwealth to let's figure out how to move forward in the best ways that we can.
Rich, I have one more question come in. Do we have time to ask it, or would you like to move on?
Really up to the three panelists, if they're willing to stay for a couple.
Are you willing to answer one more question from a person? Thank you. So this is from Joseph Bernheim. It says, Black Lives Matter in Virginia. Other than symbols or statues, how do you plan through legislation and budget priorities to combat structural racism in the Commonwealth? Please be specific.
Yeah, that's a complex question. Racism is part of just about every system that we have working in this country and in the Commonwealth. You know, since the first African-Americans were brought here 401 years ago, you know, for a big chunk of that time, involuntary servitude or slavery was part of the law. And then after that, for a long time, secondhand citizenship existed de jure or de facto. And some ways it still does. The way I'd start is, you know, going to the root of the problem, I think, is we've got to reform the way we do policing in this country. We've got a I've argued for a long time that every police officer ought to have crisis intervention training, de-escalation skills. And I've primarily argued for that because some mental health issues are implicated very often in police encounters. And I think that's a way to better deal with people that might be struggling with mental illness. But I think de-escalation skills could be a big factor. If a police officer is armed with those, that could be a big factor in every single encounter. I also think, and I'm pleased to see that there's some proactivity in this regard, that implicit bias training needs to be part of a police officer's training. It needs to be part of what's taught at every academy. And I think we've got to find a way to make sure that the training process is reformed, and that's going to require probably both legislation and budgetary work. I think that's where we begin, but that's just the beginning. I mean, we've got a lot of work to do.
I would echo what the senator said in that I think maybe we should spin the question around, and instead of open-ended asking what are we going to do to combat structural racism, ask ourselves every single time we're talking about a specific policy, how do we confront the racist dimensions of that legal framework? So if we're talking about schools, how do we talk about redistributing resources more equitably, because we know that the neighborhoods with the lowest property values are the ones that have historic entrenchment of wealth inequality and therefore are having trouble funding their schools and paying their teachers what they deserve. When we're talking about criminal justice policy, why are the neighborhoods with more Black and Brown Virginians being over-policed? So we could talk about this all day, and I think we should every single time we've got a policy before us. You know, when we talk about, Delegate Runyon talked about how that we are concerned about the cost of confronting climate change and their implications for consumer bills. We know that among the Virginians that are energy burdened and paying too much for electricity, it's disproportionately Black Virginians as well, because again, they disproportionately live in the neighborhoods with the older housing stocks, with less energy efficient homes. And so they're having a harder time making the most of the energy they're paying for. So it's in every single thing we do, we can ask ourselves, where does racism operate here? And I think if we're being honest, we should.
I think both the senator and the delegate had wonderful answers, and I agree with much of that. I think we need to identify issues. We need to understand specifically where structural racism occurs. I like what Sally said, that we need to ask that question when we evaluate legislation. And you know, we're probably going to disagree about the solutions to those, but let's have that conversation and figure out where we want to be, because every one of us in the Commonwealth want to have a community, a society that is colorblind, that has nothing to do with what the race of an individual may be, for what opportunities they may have. And I'm optimistic that we get there. You know, there have been lots of things this last several weeks that are uncomfortable for Virginians, but perhaps it allows us to have that conversation and be able to achieve results that, again, benefit the entire Commonwealth that maybe historically we shied away from. So again, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic there's an opportunity to move forward.
And everybody that's in on this conversation is, of course, doing the right thing, participating, talking about issues, paying attention. So make sure that your neighbors join a group such as this and do these kind of things. I can't help it as a civic educator, but to remind everyone, to get the word out and to pay attention. But this is the way things happen and the way things change.
So Meg, on behalf of all the members of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia, I want to thank you as well as Delegate Runyon, Delegate Hudson, and Senator Deeds for participating in the 25th Annual General Assembly Report of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. Very much appreciated, and I think we've learned a lot today, and we wish you all
well. I know, I did.
So thank you.
Thank you all. We appreciate
you. Thank you.